Hi, welcome to Measure the Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who use them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument, or I guess in this case, a city.
It's just a thing. Yeah, we'll get into that.
Maybe it's ancient or maybe it's brand new from somewhere in the world.
In this case, from a very specific place in the world at a very specific age.
Yeah.
We're going to tell you about what it is, where it is, when it was built, who built it, why it was built, how it was built. We're going to just follow it.
Yeah.
We're going to do the whole thing. This is our 10th episode. You know the drill.
Okay, so the topic of this episode is actually our first request. So, yay!
Yes, thank you, Brent, for sending in this request.
Yeah, especially because it's actually a civil engineering drainage-based project.
Ooh.
And if you guys recall, we did the London Interceptor Sewers.
Yes, do you remember that?
It's one of my favorite episodes. And by listening numbers, basically, it's our least popular episode.
Yeah, it's kind of a gross topic and like it's kind of a bunch of gross stories surrounding a gross topic, but you should go back and listen to it.
Yeah.
Because it's not that gross. It's like a happy ending.
Yeah, and drainage is cool, guys. Like you guys are all wrong. We're doing it again today.
Yeah, that's it. Just listen to it. You'll probably enjoy it more than you expect.
All right, so today we're going to talk about Chicago. Just how it was built and why it was built the way that it is.
Yes. Now, for those of you that don't know, Chicago is a
city in Illinois.
Illinois is
a state
in the Midwestern United States.
Yeah. So it's actually at the end of Lake Michigan, which is one of the Great Lakes.
Yes.
Lake Michigan kind of looks like an eggplant that's standing up. Okay. So it looks like an eggplant. And then at the bottom tip of the eggplant is where Chicago is.
Chicago's right at the tip of the standing up eggplant emoji, is what you're saying?
That's all I'm saying.
Yes. We're adults. But we're millennials, so we know what the eggplant emoji is all about.
Anyway, it's been a city since 1837. And it's basically located between the Great Lakes, so Lake Michigan, and the Illinois River.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of very low-lying. It's a little bit of a swamp when it was first built.
Yes, not anymore. Apparently, Chicago is very nice. I've never been there, but I've heard good things.
Yeah. And we're going to tell you how it got so nice.
Cool.
It is, by population, the third largest city in the U.S. I think it used to be the second largest city in the U.S., which is why it was called Second City.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. I wouldn't have expected that. I know that Chicago is big, but
2.7 million people just in Chicago proper, like a lot more within the greater metro area.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to start way back. That's kind of the main facts of Chicago.
Okay.
Chicago, like I said, was in very low-lying wetlands. There wasn't really much drainage. And they tried to do a lot of things in the early 1800s where they put like wooden boardwalks on the street level so that everything would kind of drain between the boards.
Okay, that it makes sense, but wouldn't wood be a poor...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it rotted very quickly.
Good.
And horses that were walking on it would just kind of go through the boards. It wasn't a good solution. You know, water, even if it was under the boards, like it wasn't going anywhere.
Right.
So it would just kind of stand there. A lot of water closets, I suppose, or like privies, as they were called in North America, would just drain into people's basements. Like that sounds very familiar to London, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So that's pretty bad. Not a great situation. And this is 1837. Okay. So that's pretty bad. When was the Interceptor Sewer?
The Interceptor Sewers in London was built in 1858 to 1865.
Okay. So we are pre-Interceptor Sewer. So Chicago was in need of a new innovation.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
I mean, this was an ongoing problem. So was, of course, all the diseases that came with it, like typhoid, dysentery, cholera.
Cholera.
Oh, yes.
An ugly one.
Team favorite.
Not my favorite.
Basically, they dealt with it. And all of North American cities were kind of more or less like this. They didn't have a central drainage system. Remember that London, 1855, that was basically the first comprehensive sewage network.
Yeah.
So nobody else was doing this. anywhere.
Cool.
By 1855, Ellis Sylvester Chesbro. So this is going to be our first name, our first hero of the story.
Ellis Sylvester Chesbro.
I know. What a name, right?
Yeah. But it's distinctly Midwestern as well. Yeah.
So he started as the Boston's Water Commission chief engineer, and he left that job to become Chicago's sewage chief engineer.
Okay.
And he proposed the first comprehensive sewage network of any major city in the U.S. And this was about 1855.
Okay.
And his system was based on actually the design of the London Interceptor sewers. He understood very much the need for not just localized little fixes, but comprehensive network for the whole city.
Right.
And he backed it up with evidence from London.
Okay. And so then I might be getting ahead of you here, but Chicago being on a lake, they wanted to get everything from everywhere in Chicago into the lake, right?
Well, I'll get into that a little bit, but basically the defining difference between Chicago and London is that London had the Thames, which was this major flowing river.
Yeah.
And it was going to sweep everything into the sea, right? It brought all the waste out of London and away from London.
Yeah.
Whereas Chicago is not really going to have that luxury because the river that kind of goes through Chicago drains into Lake Michigan.
Nice.
Water intake from Chicago also comes from Lake Michigan.
Lake Michigan, yeah.
So you're pooping while you're drinking. Not great.
Especially if you want to avoid cholera.
Yeah, exactly. So the plan that he developed was not necessarily to drain waste directly into the lake, but to drain it into the Chicago River, which was right nearby, and have that water from the Chicago River dilute the waste before draining it into Lake Michigan.
Okay.
And he understood that at the time that was not a good permanent solution. He's saying, you know, like there was already a lot of population boom. It wasn't going to be a great solution for the long term if population growth kept going.
Okay.
But that was his short term plan.
Gotcha.
And in 1856, so about a year after he developed his plans, the Sewage Commission actually sent Chesbro to visit several European cities to discover and explore what their sewage disposal techniques were.
Oh, nice.
Which is amazing. Like, yeah. I wish I got sent to several European cities to discover what they're doing with trains. Like, well, that would be great.
Yeah, but that would also be distinctly more pleasant than going to tour European sewage systems.
I'd still take it. If anybody would like to send me on a trip to European cities to tour sewage systems, I'd do it.
You would? Oh, that's awful. I want to go nowhere near it. Because European sewage is basically the same as, it's all just human sewage.
Yeah.
Which is not.
But like you still get to go to Europe and tour. Like you're not like living in the sewers. You're not like Ninja Turtling it.
But you're going to be like at some, I don't know, some famous restaurant or something that you've been excited to eat at, and you're gonna like walk in and they're gonna serve you your food and you're gonna be like, you know what, I'm only here because I need to check out how they dispose of.
You're gonna be seeing that plate of food later.
Yeah,
is that what you're
exactly
saying?
Exactly. It's just I don't know. I
gross. Okay, so anyway, they went with Chesbro's plan and decided that yes, the city needs a fully encompassing sewage system. However, because Chicago was already at lake level, shit flows downhill, right? Remember, that's...
Yeah, that's how it...
First principles of sewage design.
Yeah, basic math.
Yeah.
Basic physics.
So to make it actually flow downhill into the river, they had to raise the street levels of Chicago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So rather than burying kilometers of sewers and pipe network, they laid the pipes directly on the streets and filled back up and raised the street level sometimes as much as 3 meters.
So why was that easier than burying? Is it because it was like a wetland, like a marsh?
Because if you bury it, it wouldn't drain into the lake. The lake would drain backwards into the pipe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And they didn't... I mean, I think they had pumps at the time, but it wasn't going to be as... economic, I suppose.
Yeah, well, you'd have to pay somebody to stand there pumping all day.
No, that's not how it works.
you'd have to buy some, like, I don't know, donkeys and have them walk around in a circle like they do on the old mills.
Well, that wasn't the option that they went with.
No, yeah. Okay. Okay, so they raised the city of Chicago. All right.
Yeah, the famous saying was, pull Chicago out of the mud.
I like that. It's a catchy slogan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's also, they could have built pumping stations like they did in London. Remember, the sewage was actually pumped back up at two points back into the Thames. But all of Chicago was so low to begin with that every time it rained, Chicago just turned into a mud pit. Like nothing drained anywhere.
And like, I know, okay, so on a big lake next to a big river, it's a great location to be.
Yeah.
And then it's also kind of on the way. I mean, in a lot of ways, it would have been acting as a gateway to sort of the prairies and all of that. I understand why Chicago was significant, but this still seems like a lot of work.
Yeah.
Could they not have just gone
and moved Chicago somewhere else?
Chicago, like, you get ghost towns all the time. How many people, do you know how many people were in Chicago at this point?
I think when the plan was initially proposed, it was about 80,000 people, which at the time is quite a lot.
Okay,
but
yeah,
the reason why Chicago was really important is because it was, like you said, the gateway into the prairies, but it was a port, right? So ships would come through into the Great Lakes and then they would be able to actually go through and into the Chicago River and then into the Mississippi River network.
Okay.
So it was a important shipping route.
Right.
Point.
Interesting.
Okay. Basically, they raised all the street levels by roughly 2 to 3 meters. Mm-hmm. They raised, of course, buildings with it as well, because you can't have buildings being semi-buried in street levels.
Sure.
So a lot of buildings and sometimes entire city blocks, like they would raise the entire city blocks.
Wow.
By several meters. And I'll go into the science of how they did that and how we kind of do that nowadays. Mm-hmm. But it was a huge endeavor and they did it so smoothly that businesses were still operating. So there was a very famous hotel that was being lifted and it was said that it was so smoothly ran and the operations were so good that the guests didn't even notice that they were being lifted.
That's insane. So wait, hold on a second. There were people in the hotel as it was being...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was just okay.
I think it was like quite a spectacle at first, but by the time they were starting to lift so many buildings in Chicago, it was kind of business as usual.
Oh,
so
man.
People were still coming in and out of the shops and whatnot and going about their day.
Right. Okay. I find that so crazy that they allowed people to stay in the buildings as they were lifting them.
Yeah, and part of that is also the buildings that they thought weren't nice enough to be lifted. Basically, there were a lot of quickly built wooden frame houses or shacks that were in Chicago. They, instead of lifting them, just moved them to the suburbs, to the edges of Chicago.
Wow. All right. There you go.
But yeah, there were accounts saying that, you know, buildings were getting lifted all over the place, sometimes like just completely relocated. And they didn't have like motorized heavy moving vehicles at this time, right? So they would put buildings kind of on rollers pulled by horses, horses nice. Going out of town, right? It was just such a common occurrence to see this entire building like moving down the street that nobody thought that much of it anymore.
That's pretty amazing. Okay, I'm impressed. Color me impressed.
Yeah, very huge endeavor. Basically done throughout the 1850s and the 1860s. A little bit of a downer is that basically in 1871, the major Chicago fire destroyed most of the buildings that were lifted.
Oh, well, you know.
Yeah. So all of downtown was destroyed in 1871, with the exception of about 3 buildings.
Oh, if they had only just waited.
Yeah. But
that's not funny. Oh, my God. Forget. Don't. Yeah. Okay. It is kind of funny.
It's a little bit futile, but. That's a very common thing, actually, right? Because the city of London also experienced some major fires and entire cities were rebuilt. Same with Paris.
Yeah.
Lots of major cities have gone through that kind of rebirth.
Yeah.
Okay. 1861. So remember, Chesbrough was actually the chief engineer for the sewage commission, right?
Yes.
In 1861, the Board of Sewers and the Board of Waters were incorporated into one single body of the Board of Public Works.
Okay.
Which means Chesbrough was now the chief engineer of both. So now he has to worry about the fact that he's dumped a bunch of human waste into the drinking water source. And now okay. he finally has to actually worry about both things.
Hold up. So things were so separate before this that he was able to just be like, we need a sewer. It's all going to lead here.
Yes.
And now you figure this out.
A little bit.
And then now it's just like, oh, drat, now I need to figure this out.
I mean, I don't know if that's exactly how it went down, but basically it became his problem.
That is so amazing to me. Okay, so they're lifting buildings with not only like residents, but they're lifting buildings with paying customers
yeah.
inside. And also they're just like dumping stuff.
Yeah.
Figure it out later.
Yeah. But wow. now, okay, so about 5 years into the operations, he became responsible for both the waste and drinking water.
Okay.
Drinking water came directly from the lake, like I mentioned, with water intake pipes in the lake. So now he had to figure out, well, how do we get this drinking water to be of higher quality? So his next ambitious plan, which is to extend the water intake pipes much further into the Lake of Michigan.
Okay.
So that it would be hopefully further from the expelling waste.
Right.
It would have a chance to dilute from the lake water levels and all that. And he ended up proposing like this huge water tunnel about 3 kilometers into the center of the lake.
Okay. 3 kilometers. Yeah. Lake Michigan is big.
So it's kind of cutting across the eggplant, not yeah. the long way, but like.
Yeah. I don't know. I know that dilution goes a long way.
But right? it's not going to stop cholera. Yeah. yeah.
3 kilometers of dilution, but it's just like, you know, I don't know.
It's like if you poop on one side of the bathtub, would you still want to drink from the water in the other side of the bathtub? Like, I wouldn't.
A really small poop. I think it would still ruin it for me. So, yeah. I don't love it. But hey, guess what? We live on a great lake. And when we get a big rainstorm, it's not so good.
Okay. I'm going to go more into why today is a little different. The situations that we have.
Yeah.
But just to finish up the history, basically Chesbrough knew that even when he first proposed his plan to drain everything into the river and into the lake, that it wouldn't last forever. That wouldn't be a good permanent solution. And so he had the foresight to say, at some point, we're going to need to reverse the flow of the river so that it actually brings all our waste back the Chicago River and into the Illinois River and then away from us into the Midwest, taking water from Lake Michigan to flush out everything upstream.
Okay. That is amazing. So they had to reverse a river.
That's what he...
What he wanted to do.
Wanted to do, but he knew that, you know, the technology wasn't there, the need wasn't quite there yet, but he thought, okay, 50 years from now, perhaps, we're going to need to do this.
50 years from now, we can change the physics of rivers.
Yeah.
Okay. I like it. I like this guy.
And actually, by 1886, which is the year that Chesbrough died, Rudolf Herring was appointed to study the sewage and water problem. Okay. So he was an internationally known engineer. He served as the commissioner of the National Board of Health. I find that quite cool. You know, an engineer in the Board of Health totally makes sense at the time.
Sure.
And after a full year of study, he recommended that the city stop using Lake Michigan as both a sewer and a water source.
Good for him.
It took a full year for him to come to that conclusion.
Well, I mean, it's a big lake.
Like, John, how long did it take you to figure out that this wasn't a good idea? No, how long have we been recording?
Yeah. Oh, it took me 0 seconds to figure out. But I do understand, like, everything that we eat and drink and all of that has, like, trace elements. And if you're talking about 80,000 people, all feeding into a gigantic lake.
Yeah.
Ideally, it should be down to trace elements. I understand that. I don't love it, but I do understand it. You know, it's like basically, you know, I would feel the same way. I drink water out of the tap.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's gross, but you're living it.
Yeah.
And trace elements are like good for you.
Sure.
You know? Yeah. It's all just there. It's gross. It's gross and I hate it, but I get it.
Yeah. So by 1886, he did a full year of study. And by 1889, he had developed a plan for canals to divert the rivers away from Lake Michigan to the Illinois River. So he basically created a backward flow of rivers.
Okay.
Taking clean water from Lake Michigan to flush the waste back towards the Illinois River, completely altering Chicago's natural drainage patterns.
Right.
And the idea was that this canal would also be navigable. So it would open up this ability for bigger ships to go from the lake into the river.
Okay.
So there's kind of a trade element.
Yeah, not bad for a man named Rudolph.
And the dilution from the Lake Michigan waters would naturally treat the wastewaters from Chicago. This was actually completed in 1900. And that was great. That worked really well for a while. But diverting that much water to flow backwards actually would lower the levels of Lake Michigan and Lake Huron by about 15 centimeters. And now all of the other places around the lake that depend on the lake are starting to say, well, what's the long-term ramification of lowering lake levels that much?
Right.
So they had to control the amount of water being diverted.
Okay.
Right. So then this canal couldn't just be a natural canal. They built a 3-lock system of dam on the other side of the canal where it meets the Chicago River so that they could actually control how much water was coming from the lake. And because they're doing that, that limited how much waste the canal could actually handle,
yeah.
Which again, the population cap was imposed on Chicago. And of course, Chicago reached that very quickly. So then became not a good enough solution.
That's kind of funny.
So by that point, which was about the 1908, so the year 1900 was when the canal was finished. By 1908, the population had already exceeded the dilution capacity of the canal.
Nice.
So it was about good for 8 years.
8 years. Pretty good return on investment, if you ask me.
I mean, that's kind of when they rang the alarms, right? When they're just like, we're going to need to do something about this again.
Oh, man.
Which is when they finally, in 1920... implemented the first sewage treatment plant.
Okay. So before this, they were just sending
just
it
waste.
Down the Illinois River.
Yes.
Oh, where does the Illinois River lead from there? Do we know?
Chicago, Illinois, and then it goes into like the Mississippi watershed.
Okay. So they're really just sending it down.
It eventually goes, I think, to the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, eventually, but it passes an awful lot of cities on the way.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
Actually, there was a lot of opposition to the construction of the canal because all the cities that were along this canal that was going to suddenly get this influx of Chicago waste was just like, we're not okay with this.
No.
And they said, well, there's a natural sanitation and filtering that happens when you have flowing water and waste with oxidation. It's going to be fine, guys. It's going to be fine. There was a lot of opposition to this. They got overruled by Chicago.
Oh,
it got
man.
Built anyway.
Okay, so I'm just looking at it here. Major cities on the Mississippi River got St. Cloud, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota. They're probably upstream from Chicago. My geography's not great, but so that's fine. So Minnesota's out of it, but you got St. Louis, Missouri, Memphis, Tennessee, Baton Rouge, and New Orleans, Louisiana.
Yeah.
All just getting that Chicago waste.
Yeah, but I mean, by the time it gets that far, it's been diluted multiple times over.
I know, but it's still like...
Yeah.
Just imagine, oh, okay, here's this glass of water. Somebody from Chicago
yeah.
pooped in this a week ago. tiny bit, just a tiny bit. You know, it's just, I know we drink poop water. Everybody drinks poop water all the time, but I just, it's not a nice thought.
Yes. And like I said, the smell, and I think like the visual qualitative properties of the water would be fine by dilution, but it doesn't get rid of your microbes, right? So until you actually implement your first sewage treatment plant with the appropriate amount of treatment of the biological substances, you're not going to get rid of typhoid. You're not going to get rid of cholera. You're not going to get rid of dysentery.
Sure.
Giardia. These are things that like happens when you just drink lake water or river water. People still get this when they camp and decide to just drink unboiled, unfiltered water.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. 1920, they finally built their first sewage treatment plant. By 1930, they had 4 sewage treatment plants in service. And this is going to be interesting because I think in the London sewage episode, we talked about how they drained everything into the Thames, but we didn't really go into how they treat water and how we do treat water. So I'm going to get a little bit more into how that side of the system works.
Oh, thrilling.
Okay. Remember that basically all of this stemmed from one guy deciding that the drainage problem solution should be just to raise everything. Right? Lift everything up, drain it to the river, drain the river to the lake. Well, that becomes a big problem. Drink it backwards into the river. Well, that's also a problem. Well, add a lock and dam system. Well, now we're not really fixing the first solution. Okay, well, now we're going to need sewage treatment plants.
Is this what people mean when they say robbing Peter to pay Paul? Is that what that, this is the sort of, like, is that...
No, this is the type of thing that keeps me employed and other engineers employed because development is always going to happen. As population grows, every city is just going to run into more and more issues. And I'm going to talk about actually what today Chicago is actually implementing even further as a result of all of this development and what they're doing now about the sewage treatment.
Okay.
And sewage storage.
I was so excited. I thought that I had finally found an appropriate place to use that phrase, but no such luck.
Yeah. Well, you know, keeps me having a job.
Well, I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. So next we'll get into the science and innovations of things.
Perfect.
So getting into the science and innovations of things, let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
So the first thing they really did was lifting the buildings, right?
Yeah.
So what they did was, like I said, laid the pipes for the sewers directly on the streets and then covered it with dirt, building the roadway and the streets on top. So that means the buildings had to be elevated. Mm-hmm. And in the large part, what they did was elevate the buildings with jack screws.
Okay. And so these are jack screws, like kind of what they used like under the Kansai Airport?
Yeah, very similar, except they're more manual, right? So the ones under Kansai Airport are clever because they probably can be operated from a computer to say how high each thing should be jacked or even self-leveling.
Yeah, but then computers were, you know, not quite so good back...
In 1850.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So basically, each of those jack screws had to be operated by a person manually. And the name belies the fact that it jacks by giving a screw basically a turn.
Okay.
Right? So it would screw up the screw shaft and then it would go up and thereby lift whatever it was supporting.
Yeah.
And I'll go into a little bit of how buildings get lifted nowadays. I don't have specific step-by-steps of how they did it back then, but I can't imagine it's going to be that different.
Sure.
So the simple way of explaining foundations is either the foundation of a building is just one flat piece of concrete that you've poured, and then you put your building on top, right? So you're just giant slab of concrete would be your foundation. And that's a slab foundation, slab on grade.
Right.
And back then, that wasn't actually super popular. I don't think that was even really invented back then, because right. we didn't really build things out of concrete back then.
Well, and I imagine that, yeah, that would have been probably quite expensive as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So generally older buildings, you know, if you think of a building frame being columns and beams, right? Mm-hmm. The columns being the things that kind of sit on the ground, what they would do is basically build columns that would be sunk further into the earth. And so you might have very deep columns that go in, and those would be actually called piles once they're in the ground. And that would be the foundation.
Okay. I think that that makes sense. Yeah.
So to lift a building like that, if you can imagine all of these columns have basically like feet going deep into the ground, you would actually lift between them. So you would put a beam perpendicular to all the other beams of the building. So you would slide a beam underneath all the other beams.
Mm-hmm.
And you would do that at intervals. Okay. Between each column, basically. And then you would put jacks underneath that big support beam that you've just inserted.
Okay.
Underneath the building. And then you would jack that up.
Okay. So kind of just like what? Lifting a car?
Yeah, more yeah. or less.
But then with lots and lots and lots of jacks.
Yes.
And then you move an entire building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as you lift it up, people would go underneath then to build the foundations up, and usually a basement.
Okay.
So then that's how basements would get built back then.
That's kind of clever.
Yeah. So to give you an idea of how many people or how many jacks it would take to lift something like this, the Tremont House, which was a prestigious hotel, was lifted 2 meters by 500 men.
Wow. Okay. 500.
Yeah. Because each of your jacks kind of need to be operated in synchronized motion.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to jostle the building around too much or...
Yeah. You don't want to be unlevel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So each jack has to be given the same amount of turn at the same time. So then there's the synchronized motion of all these men giving each jack like a quarter turn or half a turn.
Okay.
And it works really well because these buildings back then were basically either wood or masonry.
Yeah.
So very heavy buildings, but very resilient, dense buildings. Like they don't give, like they don't move.
Yeah, it's like a fruitcake, right?
It's like a pound cake versus yeah. like a cheesecake.
Yeah, exactly. One of them looks a lot better, but you try and lift it.
But all that to say, like modern buildings or modern skyscrapers that are built out of like steel and glass would be much harder to lift because those things don't have as much resiliency
right.
to movement, right? But masonry, big brick houses or whatnot, they were easy to lift. An entire half city blocks were lifted by 600 men operating 6,000 screws.
That is insane.
Yeah, it's quite impressive. But it was so smooth that even, you know, the guests in the hotel were reported not to have noticed the lift at all.
I absolutely cannot imagine just that they were able to lift a hotel with people in it.
Yeah.
Man, occupational health and safety. That's all that I can think of in that context. It's just like, oh yeah, no, there's people here. Like I would be angry if I was in the hotel as a guest. And then they're just like, and then I kind of come out and I'm like, oh, are we two meters higher than
all
we
of
were?
A sudden?
Yeah. And just like come down and you're just like, hold on a second. This is new dirt down here. What happened here? Be like, oh, we lifted it while you were asleep. I'd be angry. Even if I didn't notice it, I'd be angry about it.
It was very apparently run of the mill. They were doing this with the entire city and they just didn't shut it down, right? Everything kept going, running business as usual.
Wow.
So that was the lifting of buildings. There was also, of course, the relocation of buildings. Like I said, the buildings that were deemed not beautiful enough or not modern enough to be worthy of being in the new Chicago,
mm-hmm.
the new lifted out of the mud Chicago. They were basically relocated to outside of the main city center, and they were mostly done by rollers. So they would lift them out of the foundations they were in, put them onto basically like a slat or some type of wagon
okay.
of some sort, and then put on rollers and then pulled by horses or donkeys out of town.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So like the houses that were just not quite good enough to go into the new Chicago probably got pulled by like a nice horse.
Yeah.
And then the houses that were just like, oh, we got to get rid of this thing.
I mean, a lot of them.
Give it to the donkeys.
A lot of them were completely dismantled and they said, ah, this isn't good enough. Let's just burn it to the ground and build a new building on the new ground.
Well, there you go.
Really interesting and very similar, I think, to what we saw in Romania. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us a little bit of the history there?
Okay, so basically Ceausescu was dictator. He had very specific ideas of how he wanted the city to look.
And this was in 1960s, 1970s?
60s, yeah. I feel like this was the 60s. I cannot remember off the top of my head. So he had this very specific idea of how he wanted Bucharest to look. And so he's just like, well, let's just demolish these buildings. And he had some engineers on staff and he's telling them to demolish these buildings. And they're like, some of these buildings are hundreds, thousands of years old. Like, we can't just demolish them. And he's just like, no, just demolish them. I don't want them around, basically. And I'm paraphrasing here.
Yeah. He was a dictator. He was one of the worst dictators.
Yeah. Look him up. He's a piece of work. So anyways, these engineers convinced him just to let them lift the buildings and relocate them rather than destroying them. And so you had a lot of people who basically was their home. They refused to leave.
Yeah.
And so there are these photos of people like leaning out the window, you know, waving to the camera person as their home is being moved. But that was like, apparently that was an act of protest. They're like, I am not leaving my house. Do what you want. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the workers just like, picking up this house while you were in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyhow, so yeah, that was the building relocation. It was a pretty cool story and I may have told it wrong.
No, I think you told it pretty much. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was the same idea. They lifted it from the foundations and then put it on rail, actually, instead of rollers, but they put down temporary rail and then relocated them. And because Ceausescu was in such a hurry, they didn't really plan out where to dump them. And a lot of the motivation for relocating the buildings was because of churches, like really old churches. Mm-hmm. And the engineers didn't have time to think about where to put them. So there were these weird neighborhoods in Bucharest where they had like three churches kind of back to back to each other, because that's the only place that the engineers found to dump them. And they didn't want to have them destroyed, like these beautiful old churches with, you know, the moldings and the stained glass.
Yeah, so, the frescoes? Or is that a beverage? I don't know.
Yeah, that's the paintings,
the
right?
The paintings, yeah. Church paintings.
So just very interesting, Bucharest, if you want to visit sometime. Just these dotted neighborhoods full of random churches that have been relocated by engineers who thought it was important to preserve this history.
That's right.
So anyway, slight diversion. That was how buildings were lifted and relocated. And then recall the next thing that they did was to try to get better water quality out of the lake.
Yes.
So they built water intake tunnels that were much further into the lake, hoping that drawing from the lake from the middle of the lake would get them better water.
Yeah.
And so they dug a tunnel below the lake bed from the lake shore. So imagine this thing was going to go 3 kilometers out and it was supposed to be at the bottom of the lake. And they started digging from the shoreline. So they had to dig way down, like a straight vertical shaft.
Oh, man.
And then get to whatever the bottom of the lake level would be. And then straight out by 3 kilometers.
That is insane. So you had to go basically digging under the lake.
Yeah.
With the intention of
taking in water from the middle of the lake.
That is crazy. I cannot imagine being in that mine.
Yeah. And of course, this was still in the 1800s, so it was done manually.
Yeah.
And the other thing is they also dug it from the middle of the lake. So they had it from both sides of the construction going on. So they picked a point in the middle of the lake where they thought the end of the tunnel would be.
Okay.
Built a shaft going down that would allow people to go down the shaft and start digging beneath the lake towards the shore.
That is intense.
And complete manual labor, like I said, right? Digging towards each other, they met within 2.5 centimeters of each other.
Oh, good for them.
Right. Pretty amazing.
I like that. I like to hear stories of something going right once in a while.
Yeah. So these were the water intake tunnels and how they were built. But as we saw, it wasn't quite enough to get them the clean water that they wanted. So then the next thing they built was the canal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, that's what it was called. And like I said, it was constructed to re-divert the water back upstream towards the Illinois River. And it would basically bring a lot of Chicago's waste to all the cities and municipalities and towns and villages upstream. And they were very upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of opposition. They kept saying, well, there's the self-purification theory that oxygen in the water will purify and break down the diluted sewage, leaving the wastewater, quote unquote, inoffensive and safe for consumption. So super controversial, lots of opposition, but it didn't change anything. It still got built.
Yeah.
And it's nothing that we haven't covered in terms of canal construction like we did with Panama. It was actually constructed right before the Americans took on the Panama Canal.
Oh, cool.
And so it was completed shortly before they started Panama. And so they viewed it as a little bit of a practice run.
Yeah, training.
And then, of course, the last thing that they built were the water treatment plants.
Yes.
Now, in the London Sewers episode, I got a little bit of feedback about how I kind of touched on how water treatment worked, but didn't exactly explain some of the terms that I kept using, like flocculation and whatnot.
Yeah, that was fun feedback.
So I'm going to go through this a little bit step by step.
Cool. And I will say that part of that flocculation thing does rest on me. Sometimes I'm so used to just hearing words that I don't understand, and then I'll just like listen to the context of the word and just assume that I know what it is. And it gets me through a lot of conversations in my life. But, you know, my job is to be the lay person. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us what flocculation is?
Let me go through it one by one.
Okay. Step by step.
Water purification. There's basically multiple steps, and a treatment plant can have a primary, a secondary, possibly a tertiary treatment.
Okay.
So primary tends to be removing the physical particles.
Yeah.
So the things that you can see, like the visible physical particles from the water. So it will start by coagulation. And what that is adding a chemical agent that will cause all the little particles to clump together to make bigger particles.
Okay.
Usually alum. And the way it does it is, it makes the particles have a negative charge, and you know, negative charge things will clump together. It's a chemical process.
Okay. Ions?
Yes.
Okay. So like poop magnets.
Poop magnets. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. So coagulation is going to make all of these particles clump. And then flocculation is the slow stirring of this... Oh, John, don't picture it too hard.
I'm trying so hard not to, but it's happening.
So flocculation is slowly stirring, and you don't want to go too fast because you're going to break up all the clumps again. So you want to slowly stir.
Okay.
This mixture, this black water, as we call it. Okay.
Oh, I'm too hungover for this.
And what it will do is it will leave you two layers. The heavy particles will sink to the bottom, and the very light particles will float to the top.
And then you want the bits in the middle?
Yes.
Okay.
The bits in the middle is your somewhat purified water. Okay.
Sure. Okay.
So to get rid of the particles that have settled on the bottom, sedimentation. That's really easy. You just let it settle.
Yeah. Yeah. You just let it settle, and then you got that bottom sediment. Okay.
And then you let the water flow through to the next tank. Then you filter it through sand and gravel, filtration. So that will get rid of all the other particles that have kind of floated to the top or otherwise clumped and stayed.
Yeah.
And then you might want to disinfect the water completely, sometimes with chlorine.
Okay.
Right? Or with UV. So chlorine is a chemical way of disinfecting. UV is obviously not chemical.
Sure.
So a lot of the newer water treatment plants will use UV now because we're very prone to thinking that fewer chemicals are better.
Yep. And so once you've added chlorine into the water, how do you then go about making it safe for consumption again?
So by that point, you've actually removed most of the particles.
Yeah.
And the chlorine will disinfect it for the microbial stuff.
Yeah.
The first Chicago treatment plant only had this primary treatment.
Okay.
And it had removed about 75% of the impurities.
Not terrible.
So it was fairly safe for consumption.
I mean,
you might probably still have to boil the water.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
But it had gotten rid of at least the visual impurities.
Right.
A lot of treatment plants, the modern ones, will have a secondary treatment as well. You're not going to like this much better.
Okay.
Secondary treatment basically removes soluble organic matter. So anything that actually is dissolved.
Yeah.
And how do you do that? Well, for the most part, you use another type of organic matter that eats that dissolved organic matter.
Okay.
So you might use an activated sludge.
Yeah.
Activated sludge is usually a soup of bacteria or protozoa, and it will consume all that dissolved organic matter in the water. You need to give it oxygen because it's a living thing.
Yeah.
And then it will convert that dissolved matter into just CO2, water, and energy.
Okay.
And then in the end, you just need to take out the activated sludge again.
Right. And is that easy to do?
Yes.
Oh, and perfect.
And then part of it will become waste sludge and part of it will just be reused for the next amount of water.
Nice.
You might also actually use oxidation ponds, which are kind of open air things. You might see them if you look at a water treatment plant from an aerial view. You see these big ponds.
Yeah, I believe you. But why would you ever want to do that?
I mean, why not? I spent most of my day on Google Maps. Like, that's what most engineers will have open all day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm just going to go snoop on some water treatment facilities.
Look at it. Like, go to the Chicago Water Treatment Facility on Google Maps and you can look at it in aerial view. You'll see all these big circular tanks. And if you've ever wondered what those were, they're likely oxidation ponds, which are shallow ponds given sunlight with algae and bacteria, which acts like the activated sludge. So the algae will consume the dissolved organic matter.
Okay.
And algae also needs sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
And then it will just have a byproduct of CO2.
Oh, okay.
And water.
Yeah. Well, I mean, water is what you want.
Yes. So that's your secondary. And by that point, you've removed 99% of anything you wouldn't want in there.
Right. 99% is pretty good.
For normal water.
Yeah.
Tertiary is usually for very heavily polluted water. So if you're in a place where there might be a lot of fertilizers that have actually leached into your water supply, phosphorus, nitrogen, the type of agricultural waste that might leach into water supply, then you would have a very special tertiary process just to remove that particular compound.
Gotcha. So that's kind of like a focus.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that would depend on whether your water needs it or not.
Okay.
And depending on which municipality you might be in, which part of the world you're in, some might call some of the processes secondary, like they might call the activated sludge primary, but that's generally it. First step, you want to remove
the physical stuff.
Yeah. Physical stuff. The second, you want to remove
the bits that you can't see.
Yeah, the diluted, the dissolved organic stuff. And then third, anything else that you really are concerned about.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's how water purification and treatment works. And that's for black water, which is what we call raw sewage, like human waste.
Yeah.
Stuff that comes out of your toilet.
Okay.
And that goes into a sanitary sewer, usually.
Okay, sanitary sewer. Gotcha.
And we, in the modern day, tend to separate sanitary sewers from storm sewers. So storm sewers are just capturing rainwater that comes off the street.
Mm-hmm.
So back then, when we talked about, you know, London, when we talk about Chicago's original sewer systems, it combined the two.
Okay.
Nowadays, we tend to separate it. And there are still combined sewers in a lot of major cities, but there's a lot of effort to try to actually go away from that. You want your gray water, which is your stormwater, mm-hmm. to be separated so that it doesn't overwhelm your water treatment facility, which doesn't need to be treated in such ways, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So water treatment.
Interesting.
I think that pretty much has actually touched on all the relevance to the modern day, because I kind of brought it from history mm-hmm. all the way to today. Just a quick note is that the works on the Chicago sewer system basically is still not done. There is a tunnel reservoir plan, TARP, that is a new project that is ongoing. They're basically digging 211 kilometers of deep tunnels between 3 to 11 meters in diameter underground. And the idea is that it will store water in a big storm.
Hmm.
Actually, we're doing this in Toronto right now. We're digging these huge, massive storage tunnels underground just so in case of a large storm, we can actually store that water instead of immediately flushing it out into the lake, into the river, into wherever it is that we flush out our stormwater, and that it won't overwhelm our sewage system.
Clever.
A lot of that also has to do with the way that we've developed our land, because when you develop your land, you add concrete into the ground, taking up green space that would have absorbed water originally.
Oh, right.
Right. So yeah. When you replace green land with concrete or asphalt, that water can't be absorbed anymore. So that's why actually the more we grow cities, the more water we're going to be capturing.
Yeah.
And also with, of course, extreme weather patterns that come with climate change, the amount of stormwater that we get now per year is much higher. So a lot of cities you'll actually find are enacting these very severe, drastic projects to deal with stormwater and storing it somewhere.
Oh, well, that's amazing.
You know, if you live in a major city, check out, I'm sure it's public information in your city's website, your municipality. I would be very surprised if you live in a major city and there isn't some very ambitious stormwater management sewer type project that's being constructed or even planned at the moment.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Things you never think about.
Yeah.
Right? But 1800s to now, it's ongoing. So that's our episode on the raising of Chicago and everything that came with it. I hope it was interesting. Thank you so much for suggesting another sewers episode. Yeah, really appreciate it. So please subscribe and rate on whatever podcast platform you're on. Tell your friends, share our social media posts, get the word out there. Really appreciate any amount of word of mouth you guys can provide and spread the word about us.
Yeah, and also don't be afraid to hit us up on social media and just say, this was my favorite interesting fact that I learned.
Or Vivian, you got this totally wrong.
Oh yeah, we would especially appreciate that.
We are on Facebook and Instagram at Measure to Metric and on Twitter at Measure to Met. Of course, our website, measuretometric.com. Special thanks to Astronomic Audio for editing and sound engineering this episode and all of our episodes. And remember to always measure in metric.